Hello, welcome to the European Respiratory Society podcast. This is a regular feature of the ERS Respiratory Channel. The topic of this podcast is the evolving role of blood eosinophil counts in COPD. My name is Dave Singh, and I have the pleasure of leading the discussion today. I'm a professor of clinical pharmacology and respiratory medicine at the University of Manchester in the UK. I'm also an associate editor of the European Respiratory Journal and European Respiratory Review. I'm delighted that joining me today for this discussion are my colleagues and friends, Mona Baffadel and Alberto Pappi. Alberto is Professor of Respiratory Medicine at the University of Ferrara in Italy. He is the Director of the Respiratory Unit of the Department of Emergency Medicine at the St. Anna University Hospital, Ferrara, Italy. Mona has been working in the Nuffield Department of Medicine as the Professor in Respiratory Medicine at the University of Oxford, and shortly will be joining the Faculty of Life Sciences and Medicine and the School of Immunology and Microbial Sciences at King's College London as a Professor in Respiratory Medicine. Hello, Mona, how are you?
I'm very well, Dave, how are you?
Good, so great to have you with us today. And I know this is a topic close to your heart. Very much looking forward to getting your views. And Alberto, hi.
Hi, Dave. Hi, Mona. Happy to be in this discussion, which is always a fascinating topic.
Yes, we've discussed this many times and I'm really looking forward to this discussion. So let me start by just giving a little bit of background for everybody, just in case you haven't kept up with this topic. Blood eosinophil counts in chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, COPD, a controversial topic. I think it has polarized many people's opinions. Some people love it. Some people, I would say, very resistant, don't want to use this in clinical practice. And so that's what we'll be discussing today. Why do people have these polar views? So I'm going to ask Alberto just to give us some background. Where are we in clinical practice with blood eosinophil counts as a biomarker? What are they used for? And briefly, Alberto, could you give us some of the evidence and your views on this?
I think you're right. It has polarized for quite a while and is still polarizing the discussion. To me, the evidence is quite clear. I think there is good evidence of the ability of blood eosinophils as a surrogate of lung eosinophils to be able to predict the efficacy of inhaled corticosteroid treatment in preventing exacerbation. I think Mona started with post-hoc analysis showing this relationship. Then it has been confirmed in prospective study and in real life study. So I think the evidence is quite strong. And in clinical practice, it's something very simple. It's something that everyone has got around, particularly if we consider this elderly patient that usually have a number of clinical concomitant conditions and have blood tests. So it's a way to go into personalized treatment, and GOLD recognizes it. It is a way of personalized treatment. The higher is the number of eosinophils in blood, the greater is the likelihood of having this beneficial effect of inhaled corticosteroids. Cutoff has been used to guide the treatment below 100 eosinophils per microliter. The benefit is minimal, and if we compare benefit with risk, then below 100, it's not recommended anymore. But in general, yeah, it's a way of personalized treatment to prevent exacerbation with high eosinophil count.
Thanks, Alberto. I think the numbers you were talking about is 100 eosinophils per microliter. So just briefly then, in your practice, I assume you're using it, Alberto, and your colleagues, have they taken it on board? You're saying this is a very simple blood test. Obviously, it's available to all doctors, a routine test. And it's a way of personalizing treatment to find out, to predict who would benefit and who wouldn't. Is it widespread use in your practice and with your colleagues?
It is. I would say that it has become a routine clinical practice to check at eosinophils. Because as you mentioned, it's nothing special and it is there. So I don't see really the discussion ongoing on whether to use it or not. The evidence is strong, is retrospective, is prospective, is confirmed in real life. It is something that is in the hand of the treating physician. I think is negating a bit of evidence in terms of efficacy of treatment. You mentioned personalized, and this is exactly the direction we are discussing. If we don't consider in our algorithm to treat the patient in the best way they deserve to be treated.
Thank you. So Mona, I'm going to come to you now. This is something you've spent years looking at, and some of your studies really started us along this path. Do you want to give us a sort of history of what you think you've done over the years in this area that you found interesting or you think has influenced the field?
Yeah, I would remember quite clearly my first abstract presented. It was probably an ERS meeting in 2009, where I presented some data looking at the peripheral blood eosinophil count and its correlation to sputum eosinophil counts in patients with COPD. Of course, we'd always been looking at sputum eosinophil count, and definitely from the asthma literature knew it could tell us about inhaled corticosteroid response, but we didn't really know about it much in COPD. And it was really quite a, not a eureka moment, but it was a quite an important moment when reflecting that actually the peripheral blood eosinophil count was a very good surrogate of what was going on in terms of lung eosinophilic inflammation, as Alberto just mentioned. And it was also very sensitive and very specific. Of course, you can adjust your sensitivities depending on what cutoffs you use. But to delineate a sputum or lung eosinophilia, we could definitely characterize which cutoffs of peripheral blood eosinophil counts were needed in patients with COPD at stable state. Subsequent to that, it was clear to me from exacerbations, there was a group of patients who had a very pro-eosinophilic or T2 inflammatory burden at the time of their exacerbation. And again, the peripheral blood eosinophil count was a very good surrogate for this. And so leading on to that, what we've seen is that actually, eosinophilic inflammation, whether you measure it in the sputum or measure it in the blood, and as we know in the blood, it's, as Alberto says, it's just a full blood count. Measuring it is easy, and it tells us a little bit about this population with COPD. And in fact, it's not a small population. It's probably in the region of about a third of patients, maybe even more. So it's fundamentally a critical aspect of what we can do using the tools we have with the patients that's in front of us. The work that Alberto mentioned with post-hoc analysis looking at peripheral blood eosinophil counts, first used as a continuous variable. I mean, it is a biological mediator. So using that approach allows us, again, to determine what benefits you're going to get when you introduce inhaled corticosteroids to that patient with COPD who has eosinophilic inflammation. And yes, it's been years. As I said, 2009 was the first abstract I presented when I had the data. So it's been exciting to watch it come through.
Yeah, I said you've been working on it for years. I wondered whether it was decades. So
he's too young for decades.
Well, that's why I hesitated to say that. So you've mentioned a couple of things that I think we should pick up on. You've said it's a continuous variable. And I think that this is a really key point because doctors in clinical practice love thresholds. They yes. love a diagnostic threshold above this. That might be the diagnosis. Or below that, we rule it out. What do you mean by continuous threshold?
So I guess what I'm trying to say is that actually, if you apply different thresholds, so individual numbers, you can get an understanding of what a particular group might have in terms of a response or an influence or a risk or progression. Of course, in clinical practice, as you say, a dichotomous, you'd be best above this, below this, no, is helpful. But there are some times where we have to use the ability that actually, you know, if you're looking for a cutoff of 100, then 97 might be okay to count below 100, et cetera, et cetera. So it's just about really, I think I would like it to put together with actually there's lots of other things that we can put together. Eosinophils is one thing at the start. And as we get more and more information, we might be able to put more dimensions onto that one aspect of one variable.
Yeah, so I think one of the things you've highlighted there is you always use eosinophils with clinical factors.
And absolutely.
And what we're talking about here is in COPD patients, with a history of exacerbations, this gives you extra information.
Yes.
And I think you've just said that really the probability varies with the number. So that's why you can't use an absolute threshold. So as the eosinophil count gets higher, the probability of benefit gets higher. Mm. So I'm going to pick up on something else you said. And I think this is one of the key points why we have amongst doctors believers and non-believers. Yeah, you're quite definitive that lung and blood eosinophil counts have a relationship.
Yeah.
And yet we read papers, we hear some of our colleagues say, wow, this relationship is poor. How would you respond to that?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I was in a very fortunate position to be sampling all of my COPD patients in the same fashion, be counting their sputum eosinophil counts and reading their peripheral blood eosinophil count in the same fashion. So the same counters, the same devices. And so when you introduce additional variables or differences, then you probably introduce increased effect on the likelihood of a repeatable measure. So I would say certainly in single center studies where it's just one operator, one machine, one counter, then your agreement is actually quite high, and that's why you have a good correlation. I suspect in the other evidence that we've seen in the literature where there's less agreement in terms of correlation, then it's because we've introduced multiple centers, multiple sites, different methods of measuring them. I believe there's something like 9 different machines that measure peripheral blood eosinophil counts across the world. So each one of them has a different reproducibility. Of course, sputum processing itself is not an automated procedure. It's technical and user dependent. And then what I would also say is we should never expect the peripheral blood eosinophil count and the sputum eosinophil count or the lung eosinophil count to be perfectly correlated. And that's because not all eosinophils from the blood go to the lung. I expect them to be everywhere. So if you sampled every organ, then you could add it up. Maybe then it would be perfectly correlated. But I don't think we should expect too much of the correlation per se, because we're not sampling all tissue.
So clearly, we can't expect perfection from a biological marker that has some variability. And I agree with you. I think that people are looking for a very high bar. And yet, the common blood tests we use, cholesterol, HbA1c, it looks like their variability is about the same as blood eosinophil counts. So,
absolutely. Yeah. Including troponin. And that is a routine biomarker we use for clinical practice.
That's interesting. I didn't know that. So, Alberto, can I bring you in here? But Mona's been mentioning that eosinophils are a marker of T2 inflammation. Does that help us understand why inhaled corticosteroids work better in individuals with higher eosinophil counts?
Yeah, thanks, Dave. I think this is another of the controversies which has been a long debated, and I might be too simplistic on this, but I think the evidence is quite conclusive. And honestly, I don't see what is surprising. I mean, as just mentioned, eosinophil, blood eosinophils, and their relation with lung eosinophils is a marker. It is inflammatory cells, and as any biological element has got a variability. And the distribution is a normal distribution in the population, including COPD patients, unfortunately. It's a Gaussian distribution. So where is the surprise that half of the population of COPD patients has more than 100 or 150 or 200 eosinophil per microliter, which is the mean? I mean, it's physiological. Without calling in, and that's, to me, the tragedy, asthma or ache or whatever it is, because eosinophils are not defining asthma. And of course, even if the T2 mechanism are beyond the fact that these patients have more eosinophils, because they are the biological mechanism for eosinophil to be recruited, for eosinophil to replicate and to be in the lung, it does not define asthma, the presence of eosinophils. Even in very well-defined population, we have this distribution. COPD population, we have this distribution. So there is no surprise that this patient with eosinophils that are sensitive to corticosteroids and the T2 mechanism that include eosinophils that are sensitive to corticosteroids do respond better to corticosteroids. I mean, we don't need to call any strange magician or any asthma component to be there. Well, it's different. There might be conditions where asthma plus COPD are there, but it's not required to be an asthma-like condition. It's in the biology of these cells to be sensitive to corticosteroids. Thus, if they are high, it is logical to expect that a treatment with corticosteroid would work better on this condition.
So I think you're saying that blood eosinophil counts are associated with T2 inflammation. And as you just said, it's logical then in how corticosteroids would work. And you're quite definitive here that ACO or ACOS is of no use to us as a phrase. Mona, what's your view on that?
Yeah, I would agree with Alberto here that actually, we have a disease process that we know, we have COPD, but what we're doing by measuring a peripheral blood eosinophil count that is related to inflammation is telling us about the endotype of COPD that's there. So it's not saying that there's a new disease, it's not a new syndrome, it is COPD with a particular inflammatory endotype. And I think that's the way I use it. Of course, patients are allowed to have asthma and COPD, but we recognize that. And with our clinical experience and practices, we kind of use all the tools with us, but I think it's telling us about an endotype and a potential mechanism. What do you think?
Yeah, you've said that patients are allowed to have asthma and COPD. These are two diagnoses. And in clinical practice, doctors are meant to make diagnoses. And I think if somebody has asthma when they're younger, then they smoke, and then they develop COPD, this is a patient who has asthma and COPD. I think, unfortunately, this overlap, ACO-ACOS, is used to avoid making a proper diagnosis. So I think we need to move towards being more definitive.
Yeah.
So you either have something or you don't. It's not a case of it's unclear.
Yeah, and I think, Dave, this is something really against the concept of personalized treatment, because it's a way of treating everyone in the same way because we find similarities. What surprised the patient that have a disease, an obstructive lung disease, they have similar symptoms and they have some similarity in the biological profile. I mean, personalized treatment is exactly as you said, going into the proper diagnosis.
Splitting it apart, not lumping it, as you've said.
I guess if we think about a patient who has rheumatoid arthritis, who then also has osteoarthritis, we don't say, oh, they have one overlap of arthritis, arthritides. Is that right, Wayne?
Yeah.
I mean, I guess we have to take it about that.
Yeah. Good. All good points. So in terms of personalization, there is some evidence, and Mona, you generated some of this, and I want to get both your views on this. Start with you, Mona. That maybe the inhaled corticosteroid response is different in current and ex-smokers. We're talking about personalizing. So do you use current smoking status then as one of the pieces of information to decide who would respond better to a corticosteroid?
Yeah, so if we go back to the post-hoc analysis that we performed back in 2018, it was certainly clear that the benefits for the current smokers who had eosinophilic inflammation appeared to be greater with the inhaled corticosteroids compared to those who were not on the inhaled corticosteroids. There was a greater reduction of exacerbation burden if you were a current smoker compared to a former smoker. And this was related to your eosinophil.
Sorry, wasn't it the other way around?
I think the further data showed it was the other way around. So that's the point.
Yeah.
I guess in the post-hoc analysis first showed that essentially, smokers have more exacerbation. So I guess that's why the benefit was greatest. Does that make sense?
Yes, yeah.
And then subsequently, there's been differences of opinion. And I think what it is it's telling me that the eosinophil count is going to tell me the point where someone's going to have benefit with inhaled corticosteroids. And I think it'll be appropriate for both current and former smokers. And that's what I do in my current practice.
Okay, thank you. Alberto?
Well, I would first of all suggest smokers to quit smoking, and then I can use more easily eosinophils and the biomarker to predict the efficacy of ICS treatment. But yes, I would use in any case, expecting, to be honest, a greater efficacy in ex-smoker compared to smoker. And this is even a stronger element of discussion with current smoker for quitting smoke.
Yeah. I think there's all sorts of mechanisms around oxidative stress that would make it make sense that current smoking would hamper the effects of corticosteroids. So I'm going to switch track now. Let's move on to eosinophils and the microbiome. And I've been fascinated the last few years in a number of studies all showing the same thing, that with lower eosinophils, either in blood or sputum, there are more patients who are colonized in the stable state with proteobacteria, and that's a phyla that includes Haemophilus influenzae. So we seem to have a profile of low eosinophils, more Haemophilus, non-response to corticosteroids. And there's also some information that that group then have more exacerbations. And so are we moving now towards eosinophils being also a biomarker that can help you predict? Mona, you said endotype, help you predict an endotype of non-T2 bacterial colonization.
I mean, I think it is clear. Again, the evidence has been there for a while. We first showed it at exacerbation, admittedly, but showed that if you were to have low eosinophils, then you would also have a high CRP, which was indicative of infection. And similarly, the microbiome was differentially expressed depending on whether you were eosinophilic or non-eosinophilic in COPD patients. And so I think what it is telling us is, as you say, that there's a proportion of people here who have a high bacterial burden that is driving a low eosinophil count. And they also have higher exacerbations. What is interesting in some work that we've done that showed that if you give people prophylactic antibiotic therapy, for example, in that group, it impacts on reducing their exacerbation burden. And I think what we're doing is really we're reducing that pro-inflammatory response, and we're allowing them to go back to their normal endotype, and it might be T2. And so therefore the ICS works. So I think there's a lot of complexities that we're going to have to drill down to understand what's going on. But I do think the eosinophil is telling us both about the person who's going to respond to inhaled corticosteroids and about the person who's probably got a lot of bacterial burden.
And I have actually, now I recall, I've actually seen, I'm sure you have as well, similar data around this relationship of low eosinophils and proteobacteria and asthma and bronchiectasis. So I think it's a mechanism across airway diseases. Alberto, what's your view on this?
Yeah, you're right. It looks as if even in stable condition, colonization and eosinophil do not get on well together. When one is high, the other is low. We look at this even after initiating treatment with inhaled corticosteroids with reduced eosinophils and increased colonization in those with low eosinophils. But honestly, Dave, I think you have done the most recent work on this topic, characterizing exactly the type of bacteria involved in the changes in microbiome. So you should tell us something new about it.
Something new. I think that the mechanism is the piece we're missing here. So Mona, you've alluded to using antibiotic treatment to restore a natural microbiome, and that might restore a natural state of inflammation that includes T2. So that's interesting. I think there are probably some natural defects in some individuals that allow Haemophilus colonization. And then the presence of Haemophilus then drives an excessive neutrophilic response. And that's, as we've discussed, that skews the airway immune profile away from T2 and towards this excessive innate immune profile. And that's what gives us the worst prognosis in terms of exacerbations and even death. Quite why that happens, and I have published one paper where we found that actually lower eosinophils were associated with lower levels of immunoglobulins in the airway, and including Haemophilus influenzae specific immunoglobulins. Whether there's also cellular defects such as phagocytosis defects that are heightened in these individuals, we know that macrophage phagocytosis is lower in COPD, whether it's worse in people with low eosinophil counts. So understanding all of this better might lead to new therapeutics. So it's an area we need to do more on.
Yeah, if I may jump in, you're right. Well, there is a deficient innate immune response in terms of interferons in COPD patients, and the more the patient are exacerbators, the lower is the level of interferons, so defense against infection. And in asthma, you mentioned earlier that the first study has been done in asthma. Really, it has been shown exactly the same. The higher the eosinophil profile or the T2 profile, the lower is the interferon production in response to an infection. So it might be that it is a general mechanism that is going on also in this endotype, as Mona defined it in COPD patients.
I think one of the areas that people get confused on is we've talked about eosinophils having very specific uses. So as a predictive biomarker of a drug effect, we've just talked about it as being associated with a certain type of infection. There have been studies, mainly real-world studies, that have provided a lot of conflicting data around eosinophils and their predictive ability of future exacerbations, future mortality. And I think, well, in my view, would be that there's been some confounding in these studies because patients all have different exacerbation risks, and some of them are using inhaled steroids and some of them not. So who wants to have a go at unraveling this confounding? Mona, do you want to have a stab first?
Yeah, I'll start. So I think it definitely does have prognostic features, and I'm saying definitely because I'm firm on that belief. I think, you know, with all literature, we're going to have different study designs, we're going to have different populations measured, and as you say, different preceding or exacerbation rates or risks. So that's why there's some differences in the studies. But if you look at the big studies, so if you look at, for example, Ethos recently published, that demonstrates in their post-hoc analysis that there is definitely a link with regard to mortality and eosinophils and those who are not given an inhaled corticosteroid. It may be
because that's the key, isn't it? In those not giving an inhaled corticosteroid, yes.
Absolutely. And it might be that if you, as we've just discussed, if inhaled corticosteroids are telling us about a treatment response, that it might be that they've not died because the people died who were not given inhaled corticosteroids with the higher eosinophil counts because they didn't have an exacerbation reduction. So it might be related to exacerbations. But the point is, I think it is a prognostic feature that's telling us something important. And if we look what we've got, we've got FEV1 that we've been using for a long time now. It's actually really good to have something else too. And what I would like to see is that we continue to build on more things to help us assess our patients.
Yeah, clinical characteristics and biomarkers. Alberto, any views?
Yeah, I think that the relation is there, but it's certainly less direct than what we have discussed so far with exacerbation. And it is mediated by exacerbation risk and inhaled corticosteroid treatment. I think if we define a population at high risk of exacerbation and not receiving inhaled corticosteroids, that's where eosinophils have a predictive value, both in terms of lung function decline and mortality. So this can come out from a clean design of the study, like a randomized controlled trial, and Mona just mentioned Ethos, where you can do this very controlled condition. In real life, it is more complex because, of course, the interference of treatment with inhaled corticosteroid and the selection of the population that is at high risk of exacerbation. That's where, by reducing the frequency of exacerbation, you can get the benefit on the other outcome. In a real life study, it's much more difficult to be identified and highlighted.
So where are we now in clinical practice? We've sort of dissected the scientific evidence, talked about some of the controversies. Some advice for clinicians. How do you use this? Alberto?
Yeah, very simply. At the moment, I think the most straightforward message and fully evidence supported is prevention of exacerbation in patients with high eosinophil count. I think if we don't use it, we are making evidence useless, which is a pity being physician, because we based our practice on evidence. This is a very strong evidence.
Yeah. And you said hi.
Yeah.
But earlier on, we mentioned the number 100. So anything above 100.
100 and an exacerbation risk, at least one exacerbation previous. That's the way I go and I teach my young fellow.
Good. Thank you. Mona?
Yeah, I would say if your patient with COPD hasn't had a full blood count and a peripheral blood eosinophil count, then do it. Use it with the risk that your patient has. And see what the responses are.
Very clear. So thank you both. It's been a pleasure to share this discussion with you. And I hope everybody listening in has found this informative and maybe enjoyed our discussion. So thank you very much for joining this ERS podcast. Thank you to Mona and Alberto for your contributions and importantly, your insights on this topic.
Thank you, Dave. See you, Alberto.
Thank you so much.
You can visit the ERS Respiratory channel each month for more podcasts featuring discussion between experts and the latest hot topics in respiratory medicine.